Alexandria. It's extension 720, the new extension 720. I'm Justin Coffin. 312-981-7200. We continue to explore transformation. That's the theme of tonight's program. We heard about it with Lincoln Yards and a little bit with Lee Bay, and then also what we talked about at the beginning of the show as well. And we continue. 312-981-7200. If you want to talk transformation, give us a ring, and you also can text us on the line. My guest tonight is the author of Wait, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. It's a memoir written by one-time Chicagoan Lydia Slaby. Slaby tells her story of the life before and after cancer. She was diagnosed at 33 years of age. It's a story that many cancer survivors can relate to. Once you're diagnosed and you suffer through various stages of treatment, you have to make a choice. When do you go back? Back to life as you knew it, back to your job, back to your purpose. But in this book, the real question is not when you go back, but when do you go forward? Lydia Slaby is a writer, motivational speaker. She serves on a few not-for-profit boards, including right here in Chicago. She's an advisor to the great organization, Second Story. Lydia Slaby, my guest on Extension 720. Lydia, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So this book, and let's get right into it, you kind of set it up that you're living the happy life. Yep. You know, you are high-powered and high-octane, getting degrees and working as a lawyer and working in political offices. Let's pick it up there, that you had a 24/7 life.
I really did. I mean, up until I was 33, I very much had an enviable life. I mean, it's hard. I'm not going to deny that. I had graduated from a very good university. I'd spent a good deal of my 20s working for the Massachusetts state government at a high level under Governor Deval Patrick. And then I came here and I went to Northwestern for my JD MBA, and I did 5 years of schooling and three. And then I launched out of that into one of the big law firms in Chicago's Loop. And I was busy. I was very busy. I was very successful inside that busyness, but I was very busy. And in the meantime, I also got married and, you know, life.
And how much of that was just ambition, where you were like, I need to get to a certain spot. This is where I need to be.
I was never told that not having that ambition wasn't an option. And it's not that my parents were constantly tiger momming me. It's that, you know, I had this brain and I had this education and I had this position, and I was always told and I always felt that I had to do something worthwhile with that. And working really hard and striving was my way of doing that. I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do with any of it, but I knew that if I just worked really, really, really hard, then somehow I would eventually trip across the answer.
The book starts on the days before you are diagnosed, and it really is the day that you go to the doctor.
Yep.
And you talk about, you know, just the crazy hectic schedule. You're going to a wedding in New York City, and you're coming in, you're coming out. You had a lot of things on your plate. When you think back to that moment, what comes up? What talk us about right before you go to the doctor?
Oh, that morning I'd been up until 1 or 2 in the morning the night before working on a document for work. I, you know, woke up and took a shower, and we were trying to figure out the wedding that weekend. I was diagnosed on a Thursday, and so we were leaving that Friday. And it was one of those questions of, am I actually going to be able to go to the wedding, or am I going to have to keep working through the weekend? And
it wasn't that there's something wrong with my health. It was about work.
Not at all. Right. Everything I was focused on was related to work. And in the meantime, I couldn't really breathe. My chest hurt. I was super swollen. My upper body was very swollen. And I had in the back of my mind, oh, yeah, I got to go to the doctor at 11 because of this thing that I'm dealing with, whatever that thing is. But it was very much an afterthought, complete afterthought.
When you went to the doctor that day, and the doctor started to recognize that there was something more than just maybe a respiratory problem or allergies or whatever it might be, they started to send you different places. At what point did you realize that this was more serious than you were taking it?
So my GP, quote unquote, heard something wrong with my heart. And I was like, okay, great. I'll just go to the cardiologist sometime next week. And she sat me down. She was like, no, you're going to sit in my waiting room until I get you in to see him this afternoon.
Which, for you, at that point, you're kind of, not angry, but you were frustrated by that.
Yeah. And I was like, what? Like, I've got better things to do with my time than to wait around for a cardiologist. You know, I mean, this is my heart we're talking about, right? And so that was when I began to sort of sneaky get that suspicion that maybe something was wrong. I also texted my husband saying, you know, oh, my GP's holding me hostage and she won't let me leave. And he walked out. He was working for the Obama reelection campaign at the time. And he walked out of a meeting and came to join me to have lunch with me while we were waiting up at Northwestern's medical campus. And actually, it was the fact that he walked out of a meeting and joined me for lunch while we were waiting that I was like, oh, wait, maybe there really is something wrong with me.
Yeah, why would he do that?
Why would he do that? You know, he's busy. I'm busy. And it, you know, I mean, and then the cardiologist saw that my heart was under extreme stress and surrounded by fluid. And then he dumped me into the ER. And, you know, the day sort of kept progressively getting medically worse. And so really, by the time I was in the ER, I knew that there was something going on. But even then, I mean, the cardiologist was like, I don't know, you probably had a really bad cold. And now it's just the byproduct of that. And we have to deal with your heart. But you are fine.
Right.
And even then, that was tough. Yeah.
It was a CT scan, of course, that came back and showed, and you have a very well-written passage about looking at that.
Thank you.
Where you get to the point where there's the black blob, you know, or whatever. I forget if that's the right way you determine it. But that moment of everybody recognizing that the shadow was not a shadow and that it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Right. So it was this actually amazing moment where the doctor flipped through the pictures on the screen of what my CAT scan had shown. And, you know, organs and bones and blood vessels are all various shades of gray. And as she was scrolling up through my chest, we saw my lungs and then we saw my heart and all various shades of gray. And then suddenly there was this black blob. And it was about the size of a grapefruit, and it was sitting on top of my heart and in between my lungs. And it was one of those things where it was like, oh, that's not supposed to be there. And I remember looking at the screen and going, well, that's not supposed to be there, so how could that possibly be there? So that's not actually there. Like, immediately my brain was just like, nope, that's not possible. This is like some sort of magic animation.
The control freak in you.
Yeah. I was like, this is not a thing. We're just going to pretend that this is not a thing.
And I know what's right. This is wrong. I know what's right. Right.
And it was as she sort of was scrolling up and down, and I could really see the picture of it, that was when I began to go, oh, no. And she'd already said the word lymphoma, and she was just showing it to me, showing the extent of how bad it was.
And it took a while to get to what it was. But
yeah,
you had cancer in your family. Your sister was she was in treatment.
Yep. So my sister,
there is this weight on your family already. You know what that means. You know what that diagnosis means.
I do. I did. And that was partially, I mean, I can only guess, but that was the reason why I was ignoring the diagnosis. My sister had cancer for 6 years previously. Unfortunately, she's still in it. So now she's dealing with it now for 13 years. But and so I knew in my family that CAT scans that showed like that looked like that could only mean really horrible things. And I'd witnessed it with my sister, you know, infusion suites and stem cell transplants and going bald and losing fertility and all of the things that cancer treatment does to the body. I was determined that was not going to be my life.
Lydia Slaby's my guest. Her new book is Wait, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. The story that really chronicles her life before and after cancer. We'll continue the conversation. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Lydia Slaby in studio. So stay with us.
This is Extension 720 on WGN Radio. Here's Justin Kaufman.
Continuing our conversation with Lydia Slaby, her book is Wait, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. Did you know you were a control freak before this book came out? Before you tell your story and before cancer, were you a self-described control freak?
Oh, sure, right? I mean, you can't achieve that much that quickly, that young, without having some imaginary superpower that you can control the cosmos to behave as if you want it to behave.
A lot of times, control freak will be a derogatory term. People will say, oh, you're such a control freak. Do you embrace it?
No, I recognize that it was probably not one of my more pleasant attributes, let's put it that way. But I also recognize that it was part of why I was so successful in life. And so it was a little bit of a double-edged sword. And so I very much tried to be a good friend and not control my friends more or less successfully. Maybe not. but I was fully aware that this was an aspect of my personality that had brought me both achievement as well as shame.
The reason I bring it up is that the next chapter of our conversation has to do with treatment. Because after you were diagnosed, it comes down to chemotherapy and it comes down to how they're going to rid your body or at least limit the cancer that's in your body. It must have been hard being a control freak at that moment. I mean, because a lot of this book is about losing control.
Yes, it was exceptionally hard in that moment because the whole thing was such an emergency. I was admitted to the hospital as an acute cardiac patient, and then, you know, very quickly they figured out what kind of cancer I had, and so they knew what kind of treatment they wanted me to do. They wouldn't let me. I mean, people have choice in this matter, but the hospital really didn't want me to leave the hospital until I had gone through chemotherapy. And it was all so fast. You know, I mean, like, I hadn't thought about other treatments. I hadn't thought about going to meditate in Mexico on a beach somewhere. I mean, I don't know. You know, but there were no options in front of me. And we spoke about my sister, and I called her sort of in the middle of this maelstrom, and I said, what do I do? I mean, that was probably exactly what I said. and I'll read you a little bit from the book. So, enter my sister with her years of hard-won experience fighting her own cancer. I know it doesn't seem like you even have a choice, but you do, she said over the phone, understanding my attempt at explaining these unfamiliar feelings. Either you can decide to surrender to their protocol and collaborate with them to make it work for you, or you can decide to be angry that you didn't have a choice and everything that's about to happen to you is someone else's fault. Then she told me she loved me very much. You are my one and only sister. Please, for your sake, decide to own your treatment. Otherwise, you will spend the rest of your life, for however long you have, furious and miserable about those doctors who ruined my life. And so that was the first conversation that I had, the first thought process of, okay, I can't control what's going on around me, but what I can start to do is control how I react to it.
Yeah.
I can choose to make choices that I didn't realize I had. I can choose to be kind in the face of those choices. And that was the very beginning inkling of the whole process of, instead of controlling everything outside of me, learning how to control things inside of me.
It's in the book, that's what you talk about. And thank you for reading that. And did you accept that? Did you accept the words of your sister who had gone through that? Like, because, you know, obviously for the purposes of the book, it moves along. You accepted it. But personally, at that time, were you like, nah? Or did you have that meditative moment to say, she's right?
On that particular point, I was totally delighted to have her be right because I didn't have a choice.
Right.
And so the fact that I could create a choice out of what I thought wasn't a choice was wonderful. Everything else, though, I kind of ignored her advice. Because, I mean, you know, life's a process, right?
Right.
Like, we're all growing and changing.
Right.
And so I got very practiced at it in accepting the decisions around my treatment and accepting the decisions around sort of the medicine of what was going on. I grew to love my time in the hospital. My husband and I really created it to be a fun moment for us and our friends. But the rest of it was not as easy.
You know, you say later in the book that one of the dirty secrets of that you say to the reader, you know, I wanted to be back in the hospital. The hospital was a refuge. The hospital, because it sounds like they took care of, you know, you collaborated with the choices you were making, but you get to lose control. they took control and you were able to be more patient?
Yes. And actually, that little part of the book, it happens after I'm done with treatment and I'm actually back at work. And I harbored, you're very right, it was a dirty secret. I was very guilt-stricken about this secret. And I'll read you a little bit. So here's my dirty secret. From the first minute that I went back to work, all I wanted was to go back to the hospital. Despite the fact that being sick is horrible and undergoing chemo is even worse, the hospital itself felt secure to me. In all my adult life, it was the only place I had ever felt truly comfortable. I knew exactly why I was there and what I was supposed to do while there. I was a control freak with nothing to control, so I could finally rest. Hmm. And it was this, the hospital just provided that to me. I mean, it's like, you know why you're going. I'm going to the hospital today to save my life. And this is what I am doing in order to save my life.
And everything else can be put on pause and you can put it to the side.
Nothing
this
else matters.
Is what we're doing today.
Exactly.
Which is a far cry from what you were doing before you were diagnosed. It felt like at the beginning of this book, you had 19 things going on in 18 seconds.
Yes, exactly. And it was all over the place, and I didn't really understand where my role was inside any of it.
We'll continue our conversation. Lydia Slaby is here. Her new memoir, Wait, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. It chronicles her struggles with treatment, but also life before and after cancer. And when we come back after Andrea's newscast, let's talk about after, because you know I don't want to think you can get the whole feel from the book, and we feel like we're skipping a big chunk of treatment and the things you went through, but we'll continue the conversation. Lydia Slaby is here on Extension 720, so stay with us. Thanks, Andrea. It's Extension 720. Here on 720 WGN, I'm Justin Kaufman. We're continuing the conversation with Lydia Slaby. She's the author of Wait, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. We're talking about her experience before and after cancer and the treatment, the story of treatment. And cancer treatment, for anyone who's gone through it or has had loved ones go through it, it is a traumatic experience. Your experience was traumatic, and then you add on top of it surgery, a heart surgery that was unexpected. There's a lot of trauma in your treatment.
Yes, there was. There was trauma at diagnosis, and then there was trauma in the multiple. And chemo, just in and of itself, is traumatic. And then I had a chest cracking surgery, shall we say, to remove the tumor 2 months after I finished chemo, and then 18 months after that, I had an emergency heart situation. And all of it trauma. Good stuff for ER.
There is, you know, obviously this memoir, the ability to tell this story, it has to be somewhat therapeutic to do so, but you have to relive it. You'll do interview after interview and you'll talk about it. And I always think about, you know, when reading these personal details of being in the moment and writing about being in the moment, is it hard for you to go back to that space?
Not anymore. It was really hard to write it. And I edited it a lot in order to, frankly, get through the emotional side of it so I could talk about it without bursting into tears. But it's one of those moments where I'm a firm believer that crisis helps bring balance. Nature does this all the time. Thunderstorms, earthquakes, you know, moments of crisis bring balance. And as I'm further and further away from the actual moments of the trauma, I'm capable of seeing more how they helped rebalance my life. And for that, I'm actually very grateful for them. I mean, I'm incredibly grateful I lived, because that was not always clear that was going to happen. But now that I know I'm alive, and now that I know I'm healthy, I can actually look back on it with some semblance of fondness in a way. Sounds crazy as I'm saying it out loud.
Well, you know, going back to that moment, and I know it's hard to do, but when you're faced with mortality like that, where non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I've had family members die from that, and it's not something that, because of it's systemic cancer. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, remove a tumor and everything's going to be okay. It's not, right. You know. So being in that spot, facing mortality as you go through chemo and waves that it works and it doesn't work, and having to go into surgeries, how did you approach dying?
I approach dying in two ways. One is, I was actually told early in my diagnosis that from a doctor that he would rather have what I had than diabetes. I was very lucky that my particular version of cancer, of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, they knew how to fix it. That didn't necessarily mean that they always fixed it, mm-hmm. but they did know how to fix it. So when it came to cancer, I skipped over that part. But when it came to chemo, which just destroyed me, and then especially the second surgery, where I literally almost died on the operating room table, I grew to appreciate that perhaps someone was trying to teach me something. I've never been particularly a person of faith, but living after those moments recalibrated that a bit for me. And I had to start believing that I was put on this planet in order to do something, because otherwise, why would I have had to go through this? And that might have been a mental game that I was playing with myself to just get me through the day. But it worked, because I decided that, you know, my purpose was to talk about this, and my purpose was to share a new way of thinking about transformation and about crisis that hopefully could help others approach their same transitions or similar transitions with some level of calm and some level of thoughtfulness.
There's a chapter on grace, and there's a chapter as well on living in the moment, and a lot of it associated around pain, mm-hmm. and having to just kind of be in the moment, being in the pain.
Yep.
But there is this Zen-like approach to recovery, where you have to live in that moment. And that's something you had to almost teach yourself.
Very much so. I was so committed to the power of my brain that paying attention to my body or the present moment was not something I was at all practiced at. Our brains are vitally important and brilliant pieces of anatomy, but they pull us out of the present moment, because brains live in the past and they live in the future. They literally can't live in the moment because they're talking at us all the time. And so learning how to put my brain where it belonged in order to feel what was going on in a present moment was a battle for me. But as I learned, as you mentioned in those sections, mostly focused around pain, is that when I was in the present moment, the pain got lessened.
Yeah.
And I could actually be in it without feeling like I was just going to snap in half and die at that particular moment. And I mean, and to be clear, these were incredibly ridiculous moments of such intense pain where I'd never felt anything like that before. And I've broken a lot of bones and I've been in a lot of accidents. And but being present inside that gave me something to hold on to for the pain. And so as I got further along and I wasn't in quite so much physical pain, and perhaps there was some aspects of mental agony trying to figure out my life, but once I'm not being triggered by pain, I started seeing the value of being in the present moment for other situations, for pleasure,
mm-hmm.
For life. And there's something so freeing about it, so beautifully freeing about it, that suddenly the rest of it didn't really matter.
The movie, you talk about transformation, mm-hmm. and a lot of, we kind of mentioned right at the top, this idea of going back.
Mm-hmm.
And this is almost part of the treatment.
Mm-hmm.
It's prescribed. You know, once you get here, you'll be able to go back. You'll be able to go back to work. You'll be able to go back to your life. And that was something that was told to you, and it was continued to be like, you know, once you get done with this, you'll be back. And it's interesting because you have a passage in the book about it, and I kind of talked about it at the intro, but, you know, if you find it and you can read it, it's this idea that going back seems to be part of the process.
It is. So the section that he's talking about, I'll read it now. Because the future was unknown and the present was agonizing, I decided that the only way out was to go back to what I knew, job, body, health, or my former concept of it. This instinct echoed in the advice all around me. Go back to work. Go back to the gym. Go back to your life. Go back. Go back. Go back. No one ever grabbed me by the shoulders and said, go forward. So while I focused on the present of my marriage, I pressed my brain and my body backward into the only place that I knew, the past.
It's so startling when you read that because it makes so much sense. And I do want to get to life after the treatment. Let's start with your job. So it's this idea that you wanted to go back. There's a point in the book where you talk about, hey, you know, they covered my health insurance at this place. This is a big number after cancer treatment and everything that goes into that and the surgeries. I want to give back. At what point when you went back did you realize this is not what I want to be doing anymore?
Oh, fairly quickly, honestly. I mean, the law firm was lovely. The people were extraordinarily supportive, but the minute that I walked back into it, and I still very much had chemo brain. This is a real thing. I was in a fog, and I was being asked to do the work of an associate at a large law firm, and suddenly I was like, "What? I can't do this." I mean, I literally could not physically do it, and luckily, I was in the bankruptcy section. Luckily, the economy was on an upswing, so we weren't that busy, but still, I mean, the work that I was being asked to do, I just couldn't do it. It took me longer. It was harder. I couldn't get my brain to wrangle. And I thought that if I just stayed in it long enough, if I sort of bullied my brain and my body back
into your way through it, right?
Yeah, just forced my way through it, then eventually I would get back to the point where I could think that way and I could work those hours and I could do all of that stuff. I could lean in. I could do everything. And it just became clear the longer that I was at the firm that I couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. And it was so frustrating, but I couldn't.
Did you have to, was it frustrating because you're like, hey, I want to go back to who I was?
Yes.
I want to go back to this control freak. I want ambition to be part of my life. I know I can do this plus three other things. I want to be back to the way it was because that was who at what point do you say, you know what? I'm losing control and I need to practice the things that we just talked about, whether it's the grace or whether being in the moment. When did those things that happened to you in treatment, when did they register with you that your life was going to be different?
The minute that I almost died on the operating table 18 months after treatment ended, it was just a medical disaster of a day. And I had a hole in my heart and they were about to crack me open in order to fix my heart. And I was lying on the bed in the ICU and I said, how did I get here? How did this happen? And I'd forgotten meditate. I mean, when I was going through chemotherapy, I had a meditation practice. I had all of these brilliant insights, right? And then I just forgot about all of them while I was going back into my life. And there was just this moment while I was lying on the table in the hospital. And suddenly I said, okay, I've taken a wrong turn at some point because otherwise, why would I be sitting here? And I don't mean to imply that when you land on a hospital table, it's your fault. But at some point, with the amount that I was going through, I just had to make a change.
Yeah.
And that brought back in all of these sort of Zen-like practices that I had cultivated. And suddenly I realized that I was now a round peg trying to fit into a square hole, and it just didn't work.
You mentioned it in the book, and it's a little part of it about stress.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's not a direct implication that you got sick because of the stresses of the world that you had created. But there is some thought about the way that we process stress and that the way that it manifests itself in people, especially after trauma. Mm-hmm. Is that part of it that you recognize now that stress is something that is, I don't know what the right
toxic
word to be. Toxic is it? Yeah, exactly. The exact word. Yeah.
Well, it is. And I had an interesting conversation with a friend probably a couple of years ago, and you know, any number of things can cause cancer, right? There's carcinogens all over the place. We breathe toxic air. We drink toxic water. We eat toxic food. We lead toxic lives of stress. Like, we're not doing a good job at managing our health at the moment as a society. And that can trigger cancer in any number of ways. But the true question there is, what is my body capable of handling that might be different from somebody else's body? And it turns out that my body, I'm not Dwayne Johnson. Like, I can't handle certain levels of stress. I can't handle certain types of food. I can, like, the list goes on, right? Mm-hmm. And learning how to recognize that not as a failure of my body's that I need to fix or ignore or somehow bully away, but as just a simple reality of who I am, that took a lot. That took a lot. And recognizing just all of it. Because, I mean, this body that I'm living in is the only one I'm going to have for the rest of my life. You know, it's kind of a truism. And so if I don't start taking care of it...
It's been 7 years.
Yes.
And I'm interested, because we could do a whole other hour on your marriage and talk about Michael plays a big part. You could make an argument this is a love story.
Yeah, I think so.
There's a lot in it about fixing things in your marriage that before were, happened because of the lifestyle you were living and how that was fixed or at least changed after treatment. It has been 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
How are you living differently? When you look back now and this book and everything about it, can you draw a line and say, I am living what my book is saying? I am different than I was when I was 32.
Well, I mean, my job and my life looks very different. That is true. I no longer work at the law firm. I've written this book. I'm seeing where this is taking me. I'm much less concerned about planning my life. I spend a lot of my time now trying to pay attention to the currents where life might take me and engaging with those. And I had a thought and it just left my head, but...
It's okay. No, it's...
My life looks exceptionally different. But at the same time, I don't want listeners to sit here and think, oh my goodness, she went all zen and now she's super weird about this. I mean, like, this is a daily practice for me, right? Like, not judging myself for the fact that I'm not at a law firm with the number of degrees that I have or somewhere else that is equally exalted.
Right.
Is a daily practice for me to be comfortable with that and to forgive myself for it. And not to forgive myself for the fact that I'm not doing it anymore, but to forgive myself for the fact that I thought I could in the first place. It's a daily practice. Yeah. And so that's really where my life is different. I mean, it looks different from the outside just because I've changed my job. But the inside is really the true thing that has shifted.
Yeah. Lydia Slaby, the book is Weight, It Gets Worse, Love, Death, and My Transformation from Control Freak to Human Being. I can't thank you enough for coming in, sharing your story, and congrats on the book. It's a great read. And again, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.